Hey everyone, this is Achyuta Bhava from Nightlight Astrology, and today we are going to talk about Venus entering Sagittarius and moving into a conjunction with the south node of the moon. I've gotten a whole bunch of questions about this on social media, and so I thought we would take a moment to discuss the significations of Venus and the south node together. In order to do that, we need to talk a little bit about the nodes of the moon from the ancient perspective, which I've done in other videos before, but I thought it might be nice to revisit because I haven't talked about it in a while. And there's a lot of new subscribers since I did my last videos on nodes. I've got, like I said, I got a whole bunch of questions about this and people saying, what does it mean that Venus is going to conjoin the south node? So that's what we're going to do today. After that, I am also going to spend some time on a birth chart demonstration today and talk about three different levels at which my programs prepare people to work with birth charts and give you guys a demo from my a recent client that I worked with who gave me permission to use their chart. I'm going to show you how the first year curriculum, my first year program, my second year curriculum, and my horary curriculum all went into this reading and how I try to use all three levels of the curriculum that I teach people within all the readings that I do. I'll just give you a sense if you're considering of taking my programs, what kinds of things you'll learn and what kind of prep you're getting for reading charts. So first we're going to talk about Venus in the South Node, and then we'll go into a birth chart demo as a way of talking about a really interesting person and client that I had, and also a little preview of my programs. Okay, so first of all, we're going to need to talk about the nodes of the moon in general. In order to do that, what I'm going to do is bring up my Starry Night Pro program. Great astronomy program that can help you learn astrology and the astronomy of astrology, which, by the way, is a big part of my program, especially the year one program. It's really important to understand the astronomical thinking and the symbolic astronomy that forms the foundation of astrology as we know it. So what I want to highlight for you here in this program that you're seeing on the screen, which I've artificially made, you know, into nighttime. So you're looking at the sun and it's nighttime. So it might look strange, but I'm doing that so that we can see the constellations and the ecliptic. So here's the moon. It's invisible. It's just after the new moon. And what we're doing is I want to show you what the moon does every month, because it's important to get a sense of what the nodes of the moon are. These are astronomical points that mark the intersection of the moon with the ecliptic as the moon is traveling and sort of snaking its way around the ecliptic every single month. And remember, the moon goes through the entire zodiac, all 12 signs, in one lunation cycle, whereas it takes the sun a whole year. So that's why we have the sun and the moon at the heart of what defines the zodiac, 12 signs that represent the 12 lunations in the one big circle that is the solar year. So at any rate, let's just watch what happens if we take the moon along one day at a time. I'm going to just step time forward a little bit here. And here we go. You can see the moon is moving along the green line. Now you can start to see it in the bottom left here. I'm just going to circle it. So there's the moon. And you can see that it's actually in this picture, it's just below the green line. It's just below the ecliptic. That's the path of the sun. Now, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take this forward just a little bit so that I can show you more of how the moon progresses day by day. So first I'm going to shift the moon over by some hours to the west, and then I'm going to progress this one day at a time again. And let's watch what the moon continues to do as it moves along. You can see the moon, more of the surface of the moon is showing as the moon cycle is waxing, and the moon is below that green line. Well, and see, now it's getting full. Nice. So, all right, let's go ahead and move this some more hours so we can get the moon back and see more of its journey. Now watch what happens. We're going to advance it by day at a time again. And here, now you can see the moon is approaching that green line. So here it is, right? When the moon crosses the ecliptic in its normal monthly cycle, and it's doing so as it travels above that line, meaning the trajectory of the moon is crossing that line going upward. That is called the ascending node. It was also called the head of the dragon, and it was also called Rahu by Indian astrologers. It's actually thought of as a planet in Indian astrology. Now, when the moon on the other part of the cycle later in the month does the opposite thing, it's going to kind of, the moon's going to kind of go up in this direction for a ways, and then eventually it's going to cut down across the line. And when it cuts down across the line, then going downward, that's the descending node, which is the tail of the dragon, or sometimes called Ketu in Indian astrology. And you'll also notice that when the moon crosses the line going downward, it's heading down here toward the south. Whereas when it's crossing upward, it's going upward, which is in the opposite direction. This is the north. So we could also call them the north and south node of the moon. But ascending and descending is also appropriate. Indian astrology, Rahu and Ketu. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is, what is the symbolism of these? Now, in modern astrology, in say the past 100 years or so, the nodes of the moon have taken on a very particular meaning unique to a brand new school of astrology called evolutionary astrology. There's a whole talk that I've done at numerous, professional astrology groups and online and so forth on the history of the nodes of the moon in modern astrology. The gist of it is that around let's say the past 100 years or so, modern astrologers have created new designations for the meaning of the north and south node of the moon. They associate the north node of the moon with the future trajectory of the soul, the lessons that the soul is here to learn and develop, experiences that the soul needs to have in order to grow and evolve to its next level of consciousness. Whereas the south node may represent the things learned, the expertise gained, but also tendencies toward regression, hangups, and problems that exist in past lives. And that's a gist of it. There's a famous quote that Stephen Forrest often uses that actually came from Michael Luton, apparently, who said that the north node is the south node of the moon is the bottle, and the north node of the moon is the meeting. Alcoholic and Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's generally the mood that you'll find in modern astrology around the nodes. In Hellenistic astrology, we don't take that view. For several thousand years, that has not really been the way that the nodes have been understood, either in ancient Western Hellenistic astrology, medieval astrology, Renaissance astrology, or in Indian astrology. Now, one thing that's important to note is that everything in the chart in Indian astrology, the progenitors of the word karma, the idea of the transmigration of the soul according to its karma is unique to both. It exists in both the East and the West, but in terms of the actual karmic science of astrology that comes from India, the nodes of the moon do not mean, it's not in alignment with the sort of modern evolutionary view. That's important to note, because sometimes people will think, there must be some alignment with Indian astrology. And modern Indian astrologers will sometimes take up those same meanings, but it's not really in line with the classical meaning of Rahu and Ketu in Indian astrology. So what do they mean? Well, the general meaning when the nodes of the moon are involved in ancient Western astrology is actually very similar to Indian astrology, and I'll try to explain it. So when the moon is crossing that line on the upward trajectory going upward in Western astrology, because the moon itself, these are the nodes of the moon, remember, and the moon itself was representative of what is called the sublunary sphere. The sublunary sphere is the world of materiality, the world of flux and permanence and change, the realm of the wheel of fortune, where things go up and things go down. Material energies are always in flux. So generally speaking, the moon crossing the node, moving upward toward the north, had the meaning of gain or increase for good or for bad, depending on the context. So for example, if you put, you'll find them say it's good with a good one and bad with a bad one, which means that if you put Mars with the north node of the moon, you might get someone like Lance Armstrong who used steroids in order to win. But if you put, if you were to put say Venus with the north node of the moon, it's potential that you would get someone who does really, really well in the beauty industry. It tends to be an amplification, almost like a Jupiterian like quality in a sense, something that amplifies, expands, and makes bigger. So the north node of the moon is associated with things that gain or increase for good or bad. For example, you don't really want a tumor to grow. You don't want malefic bad things to grow. Even Venus with the north node could imply, for example, if Venus is really all about lust or vanity, that those qualities are going to be amplified. So the north node of the moon tends to represent a kind of hunger or a tendency for things to grow or be really intensely developed or amplified. Now that can be, again, that could be good or bad depending on the context. And of course, in the world of fortune, everything is relative, right? So depending on where the north node is located by house, depending on what planets are configured to the north node, you'll see different kinds of things amplified or growing. Now, the south node of the moon, when the moon is heading downward toward the southern horizon, had the meaning of diminishment, decline, or decrease. But again, it could be for good or for bad. For example, it's not such a bad thing to see a tumor shrink as opposed to seeing it grow. And this is the realm of fortune. Generally speaking, the decline or decrease of fortune could mean a lot of different things depending on the context. And so the south node of the moon has the meaning, generally speaking, of diminishment or decline, sort of a little bit more Saturnine, though it doesn't necessarily have to be malefic depending on what it's with. For example, sometimes you'll see the south node of the moon in charts where people are, there's a number of great Indian saints who had the south node of the moon configured to planets in their 10th house. Or for example, I have my south node of the moon at the midheaven. And you'll often see people who have a little less attachment to worldly things, like I've taken monastic vows in my life, for example. So you'll often see a diminishment or a decrease of worldly or material things. That could mean like losing your money or losing your health, or it could mean that you're a little less attached to worldly things in general. And this sort of has similar meaning to the meaning of Ketu in Indian astrology. We'll get to that in a second. So the south node of the moon has this general sense of diminishment or decline. You don't want it to hit your wallet. Like, for example, if you had the south node of the moon in your second house of money and resources, that might be tough because it could mean an indication of diminishment or decline or decrease around your resources. But generally speaking, context is all important because decrease or decline in the relative world of fortune can mean a lot of different things. So they'll say, for example, with the south node of the moon, you'll see ancient astrologers writing that it is good with a bad one and bad with a good one. What does that mean? Well, if you have a malefic planet, it could actually curb or diminish the maleficence of that planet. Whereas if it's with a good planet, you could see it curb the benefits that good planet is trying to give. And by good or bad planet, we don't mean that there are any inherently good or bad planets. We mean the context of the planet, if it looks more benefic or malefic according to its house, its dignity, its sect, all different kinds of considerations. If the planet looks like it's there to bestow some good fortune in some area of life because that's your karma or destiny, but the south node is there, it could mean that it's going to diminish it somehow. For example, I've seen people in my practice literally, so I have one example that comes to mind of a man who did really, really well in the financial world, but then had a gambling problem. And he had an exalted Jupiter with the south node of the moon in the 12th house. So, you have very nuanced significations around increase and decrease with the nodes of the moon in the realm of fortune. These are the nodes of the moon. The moon is the ruler of fortune. Generally speaking, eclipses, which the nodes are associated with, bring the same kinds of things, depending on if it's a north node eclipse or a south node eclipse, depending on what area of the chart it's in, depending on if it's a solar or a lunar, you'll see different kinds of increase or decrease, as well as the general significations of a new or full moon. So in Indian astrology, of course, Rahu and Ketu are both malefic planets. They're both considered planets, first of all, not points. And they're both considered malefic insofar as they both represent a different kind of lust or hunger that can never really be satiated. The story of Rahu and Ketu in Indian mythology, folklore, places like the Mahabharata or the Bhagavata Purana and other places is really interesting. You've got this demon that's trying to steal the nectar of immortality. He's about to drink it when Mohini Murti, which is like a goddess incarnation of Vishnu, catches him, takes the Sudarshan chakra, which is the weapon of time, and cuts his head off while the nectar of immortality is stuck in his throat. So Rahu becomes like a hungry ghost, immortal, made immortal by the fact that the nectar is in his throat, but never able to assimilate it, never able to be fully satiated by his hunger for his lust for immortality. So sometimes, you know, the way that I think a very simple breakdown of Rahu has to do with an invisible sort of pernicious urge or hunger for something that we believe will bring us happiness. Rahu tends to be more materialistic. It tends to be more about things in this world that we hunger for, like, you know, the broad concept of artha in Indian philosophy, which would be like power or, prestige or honor or success in some area of life. And the hunger that Rahu creates for that is really insatiable. You can't ever really fill it. So the North Node can also represent like hunger, desire, lust. And interestingly, where there's hunger and desire, just like if you saw my bhakti video this week, you know, rajasic karma in general, the karma of passion, is always about trying to improve our situation, trying to improve in some general way. Well, the model of enlightenment that we find in yoga philosophy is not really about improvement. The modern Western yoga model and the self-help industry, a lot of that has to do with rajasic karma, which is not really yoga. It's not the yoga of self-improvement is not really yoga in the sense that, you know, it's not a paradigm of like trying to constantly improve our evolutionary condition or trying to constantly, you know, improve ourselves in order to level up somehow. That kind of a constant feeling of needing to be something more, do something more, achieve something more, even on the level of spirituality, is really not what yoga is about. So Rahu can provide us, however, what does rajasic karma provide us with? Rajasic karma provides us with improvement of our lot, but in a kind of never-ending rat race. Oh, you can get richer, you can get stronger, you can get, you know, better at all different kinds of things. You could win an Olympic gold medal in lots of different areas of life. But the promise of that is, ultimately not very fulfilling, because the rewards of that are not very fulfilling. It's not a very promising path, because the hunger never leaves us with Rahu. It's not like satiated ever. You've got a wandering ghost, like an immortal ghost that's wandering around. And that's a really kind of a symbolic picture of our situation as souls tied to the wheel of fortune, tied to samsara, bound up in the illusion that I can somehow get comfortable here and improve my lot, you know? So Rahu generally is going to be associated with the generation of passions that can deliver a lot of results. Like Rahu placements will deliver fame, fortune, success, power, but oftentimes with this underlying sort of insatiable hunger and lust. So that you got to be real careful of Rahu for that reason. They'll say, you know, like remediation for Rahu will often involve figuring out how to use Rahu, the ambition and the drive to do something that's at least some kind of karma yoga, some kind of, will channel your Rahu into like, you know, doing something with that ambition that serves others and serves the world. The less that it serves yourself in a sense, you know, the better that you're dealing with that karma. But that's what Rahu is really about, not like, this is what you need to do to improve your evolutionary condition. It's funny that, anyway, so the south node of the moon, Ketu, on the other hand, is the severed body that gets killed by the weapon of time. Now, one of the benefits of the severed body, of if you're killed by Vishnu, the benefit is that you're granted moksha. So there's this interesting way in which Ketu is going to be tied in with the idea of a body that's severed from its head. And so there's something about like an unassimilated moksha, a drive for moksha, which means liberation from material encagement or material suffering. But this is some kind of twisted version of it. And so you have to be really careful of Ketu as well. For example, Ketu, the south node, I have on my midheaven. How did I start my career? Well, I mean, drug addiction and then about 10 years worth of psychedelics that I used to try to get out of drug addiction, but then became sort of its own hall of mirrors and something that, you know, eventually I also had to sort of step away from. It's like with K2 will often deliver an impulse for otherworldliness, or will point you toward an impulse for freedom from material things, or freedom from suffering, or freedom from, you know, worldly bondage. But it'll be oftentimes some kind of warped version of it, or something that you can get just as caught up in. For example, you know, a heroin addict who wants to escape suffering in the world might have a more realistic assessment of what the world is all about in terms of suffering, but they may choose a method of trying to release from suffering that only gets them more deeply entangled in the very thing they're trying to get free from. And that's essentially what was happening to me, for example, after about 10 years of working with psychedelics, was this realization that this has been really helpful in terms of getting me off from a whole slew of unhealthy lifestyle habits and materialistic agendas and things like that. But also it was entangling me in ways that I was starting to become aware of that were, you know, I realized like I need to take all of these lessons and just live them now versus trying to continually generate these like high octane otherworldly experiences with a psychedelic potion. And I have no judgments against ayahuasca per se, but that was, by the way, that all constellated around eclipses that came back in Aquarius. Isn't that interesting? Which is where my self notice placed in my midheaven. So there's lots of lessons. K2 oftentimes is slightly more positive in Indian astrology, if only because the potential for someone to for K2 placements to be a little bit more in alignment with the impulse to spiritual life is there, but you have to be real careful with K2 because, again, sometimes that idea of like, you know, in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna on the battlefield talking about Krishna, with Krishna about the meaning of life is like, can I just go to a cave and meditate and check out? And Krishna's like, that's not real yoga. You got to figure out how to do yoga while also doing your dharma, or like walking your destiny path. You have to do both at the same time. That's actually real yoga, is what Krishna tells Arjuna, right? So south node of the moon can be kind of similar, where you don't want to, you know, you're not trying to like jetpack out of material reality, like checking out in an escapist mode. But if you had to choose between Rahu and Ketu, wanting to be free of material entanglement is probably a slightly healthier impulse. And so you'll often see slightly more positive significations around K2 in Indian astrology. But those are just generalizations, because both planets are thought of as malefic. It's like, I always use the analogy that it's like one of those finger traps you get from the fair, or my elementary school, there were like little game fairs that they had in the gym. I remember them. And you get them and you put your fingers in it and you try to pull either way. It's like, well, how can I get happy in the material world? I'll go and do things and try to become things and accomplish things, and that'll all make me happy. It's like, finger stuck. No, that's not the way. No, well, you know, I'll check out, man. Damn the man. You know, I'm just going to start wearing flannel ripped up jeans and shoot up. It's like, no, that's not going to work either. So the impulse, similar in diets, right? I'm going to binge and just eat whatever I want to. I accept myself, right? Rahu. On the other hand, K2, I'm going to fast. I'm not going to eat. I'm going on a 40-day juice cleanse, and never again will I have problems with food. And then what happens? You bounce back to Rahu. As soon as you get done, it's like, well, I'm going to go get some Haagen-Dazs about that. So, you know, this is the situation. So that's a broad view of the nodes of the moon. Now, let's take a look at Venus with the south node of the moon and get some potential meanings from this. Someone famous who had Venus with the south node of the moon was Bernie Madoff, if I'm remembering correctly. Yeah. And see if I can actually find his chart. Hold on. I'll see if I have it. I'm pretty sure I do. Let me just pause my recording. Yep. Here he is, Bernie Madoff. I'm going to put his chart up on the screen and show it to you guys so that you can see it. Here we go. So this is just a kind of a brief example to give you guys a feeling for Venus in the south node. So here's Bernie Madoff, and let's just take the kind of K2 analogy, or let's take the potential of the Western the Western description. So I just start with the Western one. So what we have here is Venus can join the south node of the moon in his career house. Now, meaning of a well-dignified Venus in the 10th house, which in Indian astrology was associated with Artha, meaning worldly power, prestige, gain, reputation, would could mean wealth, great wealth. But then with the south node of the moon, what we're saying is that that great wealth will be greatly diminished, or it could go through some kind of great twist of fate that diminishes it. So of course, you know, Bernie Madoff, famous, you know, for Ponzi schemes, if I remember correctly, I think they're called Ponzi schemes. At any rate, he makes a boatload of money, but he makes it in a way that's cheating and ends up losing it. So in the meantime, another way of looking at this through the lens of K2 in Indian astrology would be to say that with Venus in the south node, there's going to be a kind of otherworldly, potentially almost an escapist-like tendency surrounding Venus and Taurus. So among other things, we're talking about anyone who cheats the system, who tries to, not not playing by the rules and is seducted by a kind of desire for money and wealth that also causes the person to be deceptive and to cheat and to try to get around the way that real money should be made, you know, fairly and squarely. Not that, you know, everyone, of course, there's lots of cheating in the world, but this is a great example, in other words, of Venus and the South Node, of someone who can try to get away with something. Rahu can be similar, actually, in terms of the deceptiveness. Both qualities talked about as potentially smoky and deceptive, or kind of foggy and hard to see in the way that they work. But here's someone whose fame, reputation, merit, wealth, success has this vibration of cheating and deception surrounding it, and trying to get away with something and trying to do something and you know, didn't really earn the money in a sense. So there you have Venus, a really powerful example of Venus with the south node of the moon. Now there's plenty of significations that are going to be more constructive with Venus in the south node. We're going to talk about those too, but just to give you a quick feel for what it's like. Now what's happening in the sky right now? So what's happening in the sky right now is that Venus is, here we go. So Venus, let me put it up on the screen. Venus has just crossed into the sign of Sagittarius. And between now and the beginning of next week, that would be between now and say the 11th or 12th, you're going to see Venus cross the south node of the moon in Sagittarius. Now that's also striking up the eclipse point that will be activated through that, crossing through the area where the eclipses are going to form in December. So watch this, if we go forward, oops, I'm going by days, let's go by weeks. So if we go forward to December 4th, we're gonna see around that time is, here's an eclipse, here's a lunar or a solar eclipse forming in early Sagittarius. And the node is at the, depending on if you use the mean node or the true node, by the way, I use the mean node, but the node is in the same vicinity that Venus is in right now. So there's some echoing there about what's coming up, say in the next 5 or 6 days, and perhaps what some of what the eclipse may end up triggering. It's interesting that Venus by that time will also be in Capricorn, preparing to turn retrograde in a conjunction with Pluto, who's not shown in the chart right now. But so there's a pretty powerful sequence for Venus coming up pretty soon. And this conjunction with the South Node could actually be giving us a preview of what's going to be happening in December, where an eclipse comes back through those first degrees of Sagittarius. And then we get a very, very powerful Venus retrograde. So I would almost watch for omens of foreshadowing in the next week with this Venus South Node passage. Foreshadowing for what? Again, the December eclipse and the December Venus retrograde, which will last into January. So, you know, this is probably why people are asking about it. There's something that feels perhaps a little bit more ominous about this Venus South Node transit. That being said, what does Venus in the South Node potentially signify? Well, let's go through some of the just potentially negative significations. Anytime that Venus is with the South Node, you have that potential for anything Venusian, and in the true K2 sense, anything that can get a little escapist in nature. For example, I can't tell you how many times, unfortunately, and there's lots of examples of people who have very positive relationships to sacred sexuality, how many times I've seen people in my practice over the years come in, and they're really dealing with straight up, you know, soap opera drama and, you know, basic level sexual dysfunction in their lives, but they're painting it in some kind of spiritual terms. It's like, well, I'm thinking about having a spiritual threesome, but I'm not sure my partnership can last through it because the vibration of the partnership isn't high enough. Or, you know, it's like, well, maybe you guys should just have a real deep talk about commitment, you know, right now, because, you know, you've got a south node transiting going over your natal Venus or something like that. And a person could actually blur the lines between something that they believe is spiritual and something that might just be about garden variety lust and issues around commitment or something like that. So Venus in the south node, affairs, like sneaking around, trying to escape the commitment of a relationship, anything that can be escapist in nature can be like the south, associated with the south node. So if Venus wants to escape through spending money, if Venus wants to escape through cheating to earn money, if Venus wants to escape through, trying to dress something that's just lusty in something that's sacred or spiritual, trying to justify, you know, something that's really base desire, something that's very selfish or vain in something that's spiritual. If someone wants to, let's say, anything that could be like desirable or attractive or beautiful and also has some valence of otherworldliness around it, that could be potentially positive as well. Anything, for example, representing goddess worship, anything representing the sacred or divine feminine that's kind of amplified, temporarily as Venus passes over the south node of the moon. Anything that could involve legitimate form of sacred sexuality, even, for example, marriage vows, where it's like, you know, I'm going into the ashram of married life where I'm taking these sacred vows. It's almost like becoming, you know, becoming a married monk or becoming a married nun. You're saying, I am fully giving myself mind, body, spirit to this other person, and I'm closing down single life. I've actually seen many, many south node eclipse series working through people's seventh houses when they get married and they have to make that tough choice of like, well, I am going to commit. It's hard for me, but I'm going to commit. And then there's this sense of spiritualizing their lives by virtue of the vows they're taking. So anything that could be represent also an authentic version of sacred sexuality or spiritualizing your love life or something like that. Anything again related to the goddess that could be amplified and the spiritual path of feminine things. You also see the potential for curbing the lusts or desires of Venus. Like you'll see when Venus and the South Node get together, you'll often see people going on like elimination diets to figure out what's perturbing their body. You know, like, well, what I'm going to eliminate some things and see what's giving me some kind of bad reaction. Oh, it's the chocolate, you know what I mean? Or something like that. Or there could be some way in which you're trying to eliminate unhealthy attractions or desires from your life that are tripping you up in terms of your spending or, you know, your eating or the way that you spend your time, money, energy, or resources. Could be sometimes also that Venus in the South Node will literally reduce or curb your attraction to someone. Well, I've been attracted to this person, but suddenly I'm finding the attraction is diminishing. So you get that mixture of potential diminishment around Venusian things, or the potential for curbing appetites, or also making something sacred, spiritualizing Venus, or also anything escapist that exists around Venus. And again, remember, Bernie Madoff's a good example of this kind of this deceptive sort of escapist attitude around wealth, money, and power. That there was a lot of cheating and deception going on, and that created a false image of someone who was a good businessman. Right. And so that's classic Venus South Node in the sense of not going about getting what you want or what you desire in a way that is healthy or good or honest or something like that. So those are all things to, you know, watch for. And I'm certainly not an expert on Indian astrology. So I also defer to my audience out there. If you guys are students of Indian astrology, how would you describe Venus and K2 together? I'll frequently flip through YouTube channels and watch people talk about Rahu and K2 and always learn a lot. I've read some of the classic Indian texts, and read quite a bit from Indian texts about Rahu and K2, but, they're elusive planets and there's a lot to them. And of course, one thing that I think, Venus and the South Node can also refer to, aside from all these spiritual things, is going to be something artistic. You know, a lot of the times when we're making art, the feeling of there being a muse or some kind of otherworldly download or state of reverie or some kind of fugue state that we go into, that can be very Venus South Node-like as well. So people always ask me, is there anything particularly past life-ish about the South Node of the Moon, or is there anything more karmic about the nodes of the Moon? The answer to that is no, because there's nothing in the chart that is more or less karmic than anything else. You have to understand that karma just means action and reaction, right? So anything in the chart that's depicted in the chart is coming from previous actions, and now we're here to experience the reactions. Some of those reactions are more flexible than others in terms of how they can be changed or manipulated, depending on all different kinds of things that we do, further actions of karma that we take, including potentially remediation efforts that astrologers will sometimes prescribe. For example, wear this gemstone, or, you know, just say these prayers to these gods or whatever. Other karma is deeply rooted, and it's like non-negotiable. We don't set the laws. We petition the lawmakers in the hopes that some of this can change, and some of it can, and some of it can't. So that's a little bit about Venus and the South Node. I hope you enjoyed that. I want to pivot now into talking about my programs. Usually I promo my programs at the beginning of the video. Today I want to do something here towards the end. I'm going to do a chart demo for you guys today and show you something really cool. I want to try to show you how all three levels of my programs work together when I'm doing a reading. So my first year program, I'm going to point you to it on my website right now. And by the way, before I go into this, again, if you have any stories about Venus in the South Node of the Moon in the next week, use that hashtag grabbed. Remember, the planet's called Grahas in Indian astrology. Grabbed by the planets. Tell us your story. Use the hashtag grabbed or email us grabbed@nightlightastrology.com, where we aggregate your stories and share them occasionally. All right, now I want to show you my website. And show you my course page. So if you go to nightlightastrology.com and you go to courses, there's a first year course, there's a second year course, there's a horary astrology course, and there's a readings and passages course. I'll be talking more about readings and passages in the next couple of weeks. That's coming up in December. But my first year course starts on November 13th. You can learn all about it by clicking on the first year course tab. Right now, you can save if you use the early bird payment. Be sure to take advantage of that. And the payment plan is there if you need it. We also have need-based tuition for people who are needing assistance. The first year program is all about the study of fate and karma in ancient astrology. Now, ancient astrology is much more of a predictive science than it is a psychological counseling tool. However, it can and should be used alongside of psychological analysis of the chart and a counseling approach when we talk with clients. One of the downsides of modern astrology is that modern astrology is not typically as well equipped with predictive analysis, meaning it's harder for us to act as karmic weathermen who can tell you specifically what types of things are going to happen around what times in your life. So this program is really designed to give people that ancient classical predictive tool set where it's really the analytics of fate in the ancient world. Now, that doesn't mean that fate did not imply that ancient people thought that everything was fated, that everything was static. No. In Indian astrology in particular, the progenitors of karmic science, karma is of different kinds and types, and the birth chart shows all different kinds of karma, some that is more negotiable, some that is more changeable, some that is more fixed and unchangeable. And a lot of that remains deeply mysterious to astrologers. So we always have to approach reading for people as though your free will is completely available to you. You should always act virtuously. You should always do good deeds and good karma and become a better virtuous person to generate better karma. At the same time, we also want to help people prepare for what seasons of karma are coming, whether we like it or not, and how do we deal with that and navigate it when we're in the midst of karma? How do we deal and navigate with the different planetary weathers so that we can have a healthy relationship with our karma, whatever it may be? Because the one thing we get to choose that almost changes everything more than any other thing we could possibly do is the way we receive and respond to our fate and to our destiny. So having some understanding of what that destiny is and at what times it's coming is hugely important, even for the sake of living a deeply reflective, spiritual life and using our free will to live that kind of life. So at any rate, fate and free will go hand in hand in ancient astrology. Some people think otherwise. They just haven't read enough about ancient astrology to know better, unfortunately. But let's go Let's go into this chart example from my practice yesterday, because my year one program is designed to give you, so like just being able to understand the natal karmic context, which means the basic kshetra or field of karma that a poor person is born into, the field of fate that they're born into, and the most likely types of events that are going to occur. Then what I'm going to do is show you how in my year two program, we focus on timing techniques, which has to do with, okay, now you know what the field of karma looks like. How do you time out or pluck out the timelines that show you when the different kinds of karma in the chart are going to be activated? Because they're not all there at the same time. They're not all active at the same time. So year two, we really talk about timing techniques. How do you know when the karma of the birth chart is going to manifest? Finally, in my horary program, we throw in very specific, focused, predictive questions. When is this thing, or, you know, will this person marry me? Will they ask me out, or will I get the job? Or in this case, we're going to look at one today that was asking a question about if and when a family member will pass who is old and probably ready to pass. And so we're going to talk about how also a tool like horary can work its way into a reading and be used side by side with natal analysis and with forecasting techniques. These are the kinds of skills that if you go through all 3 years of my program, many of my students do, that you'll be developing so that you'll have all of them available to you if you want to read charts for people. So this is just a way of sort of showcasing what you'll learn in my programs. Sometimes it's better to get, you know, some live examples and just hear me rattle on about what the programs are like. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to pull up client one's chart. This is all with permission from my client. I really appreciate her letting me use the charts. So here is client one. Now I'm not going to go, there's a lot of things I'm going to leave out for the sake of simplicity, right? But let's just focus on the moon. One of the things that I'm doing when I'm sitting down with a chart is I'm looking, first of all, I'm creating, if it's a first time reading for someone, I want to give them a sense of what are some of the highlights of your natal field of karma? What kinds of themes and events and people and places, you know, what am I seeing that's going to be really defining and shaping the course of your life? And a lot of the stuff, of course, is going to be regardless of what we do with our free will, because we all are born into a field with certain fated and destined events and themes. And then, of course, there's a huge portion of the session that'll be devoted to also understanding yourself, understanding your strengths and weaknesses, and learning how to draw on what's in your chart, what's in you really, to navigate your life and your destiny to the best of your ability. But let's start by focusing on the moon. One of the things that I notice right away is like year one, we're taking natal analysis, right? And I notice right away that this is a nighttime chart. The sun is about to rise, but it's still a nighttime chart, which means the luminary of the sect, or what we call the sect in favor, is the moon. She's like the queen of the chart. Well, the moon's debilitated in the sixth house. The moon is also the ruler of the fourth house. It is therefore possible that this person will deal with some challenges around lunar significations and fourth house significations. Why? Because the sixth house was traditionally called mala fortuna, or the house of bad fortune. And it doesn't have to be the worst thing in the world, but it can certainly provide us with different kinds of challenges or frustrations, hardships or difficulties. And this could be around lunar themes, which would broadly relate to, say, the mother, mothering, pregnancy, home, family, domestic life, potentially marriage. So all lunar significations here, or fourth house significations. Now, I'm just taking this in. There's potential positives here as well. Moon in the sixth house in the sign of Virgo. You'll often see in the charts of people who they're hardworking, and a lot of self-sacrifice will go into different kinds of helping professions. The sixth house is a place of sickness. The moon is a nurturer. You'll see the moon in the sixth as a nurse or a social worker, or, you know, sometimes surgeons, or, you know, a battlefield medic, an ER worker. So the moon in the sixth house can also show like a caring disposition, et cetera. So anyway, one of the reasons that the moon stands out to me in this chart is because, and this is what we learned in my year two program, we can see right now that Neptune, who's transiting in Pisces, is in her 12th house. I'm just kind of putting it in, you know, imagine that Neptune is hovering somewhere right around here where I've drawn this circle, and it's opposing the moon in her chart. So 12th house Neptune opposing the moon in the sixth house is probably providing certain kinds of challenges for lunar themes. Oppositions are of the nature of Saturn. They can be difficult. An opposition from an outer planet to a luminary can be difficult. And we already know that the moon has potentially certain kinds of challenges because of its house placement in the chart in the sixth. So I have the natal context to know what kinds of themes are likely occurring in her life right now. Okay, just very basically. Now, so in talking to this woman, here's some of the things that that have happened. There was the loss of a grandmother in her life that was very painful, someone she was very close to, while Neptune was transiting the moon for the first time. Okay, so that's, you know, there's one, you know, sort of major event. She had a sibling she's very close to in the family who lost a child through a miscarriage, and it was very devastating for her because she's very close with her sister. So she lost her grandma and her sister lost her baby. This is both while Neptune is opposing the moon. So you see how specific the natal analysis of the moon's position and some of the more challenging things that could come up during this time. However, the moon, Neptune opposite the moon, can also be inspiring of themes of compassion, a kind of otherworldly level of care, concern, compassion, forgiveness. Interestingly, during these times, one of the things that she also rediscovered was her emotional need for her faith life. This is someone who was taking one of my programs. And in learning about ancient astrology, something that she's always been interested in, note, by the way, that the south node of the moon is returning in her ninth house while all of this has been happening. She's in my program. She's got K2 traveling through that ninth house, which is the place of religion, astrology, etc. Neptune's opposing the moon. She has these emotional losses, but simultaneously, she has an emotional reawakening of her faith, which she grew up with, but had since left, and was now finding it coming back, although in a new form. So that's one of the positives that comes out of the situation. Neptune in the 12th opposite the moon can be overwhelming, painful losses around lunar themes, but then simultaneously a reawakening of her faith through these losses. So really beautiful, right? So we have a transiting planet, which is the timing technique, activating the moon, which is the, and we have the natal context. We know the most likely themes and events that are going to happen. So that's level one and two. That's basically my first year program and my second year program at work. Now, of course, this is a really refined, simplified view of just one little part of a reading, but it shows you how important it is to be able to read natal context and then to be able to time out and know when that kind of karma, the lunar sixth house challenging karma, is likely to be activated by a transiting planet. Now, one of the things that she was in the session, she said she was worried about, this is someone who studies astrology, they said, I'm worried because I know, you know, Neptune is opposing my moon again in short time. So Neptune's preparing to move through the opposition to the moon again right now. She said, I'm really worried because my partner has a grandparent, grandmother, who is also very old, and we think, you know, could pass soon. And I wanted to know if you could see if it would be likely that she will pass. Now, of course, with just by looking at Neptune opposing the moon, it would be really hard to say who or what exactly, you know, might pass or die, or what exact kinds of challenges. We're left with knowing what kinds of themes, what areas of life, what kinds of topics, and you know, what planet activating them and so forth. But it's hard to say beyond that specifically what's going to happen. This is where horary comes in and can be extremely helpful. In the meantime, by the way, she also said, I happen to have my partner's chart that I would love for you to look at and see if you could see anything happening there that would indicate that perhaps there is, any indication in his chart that the Neptune moon opposition coming up in mine could coincide with his grandmother passing. One of the reasons that she was anticipating this is because she anticipates that this could be a very challenging, even devastating event for her husband's family. And she wants to know because the person is very old and so probably ready to pass. And so she doesn't feel bad asking about it. I think that's always probably one of the main qualifications for me looking at death in a chart is that the person is like imminently going to die or they're very old or something like that. But at any rate, do you see anything in his chart that could indicate that this is about to happen? Because that's my fear, is that Neptune's going to oppose my moon. She's going to pass. And then I'm going to have to be there. I'm going to have a really intense load of emotional caring and support. And for my husband, I just want to know in advance so I can kind of prepare myself if that's what's about to happen. She has a lot of anxiety about it. That's what astrology is for, to help us understand what's coming and prepare for it the best we can. Now, you'll never know for certain. I think it would be hubris to be able to say, well, with 100% certainty, I know what's going to happen. But can we give some, are there any signs that could be about to happen by looking at his chart? What do we see? Well, how about that 21st degree of Pisces? Here's Neptune going to cross that 21st degree of Pisces opposing her moon. And where is it in his chart? Crossing the descendant. What was the descendant? That is the Western horizon, the place of the setting sun. So one of the significations of the descendant in ancient astrology was death, when things pass away. So anytime a planet crosses the angle in the seventh house, the descendant, it often will give signs of things passing away. A planet on the descendant brings to mind the symbolism of something setting or disappearing. So it has other meanings as well. For example, consummation. When a planet sets and disappears into the underworld, it was also an image of sexual penetration, one person entering the other, and therefore was associated with the consummation of marriage. But also, again, associated with old age and death, the natural passing away of things, resolution of things, all associated with that. So yeah, Neptune is going to pass over his descendant. And Neptune is already at 21 degrees, relatively close to a square with his moon. And around the time that Neptune will pass over the descendant, we also have an eclipse in the fourth house of home and family in December. So yes, there's a good likelihood that grandma is about to pass, but let's put it to a horary to get some sense of the timing, because sometimes, you know, a horary, it's like, well, you know, let's take out all of the tools in our toolkit. And this is where the horary program comes into play. So what you've seen me do is utilize, just little aspects of my year one program and my year two program in terms of being able to identify natal context, and then being able to identify transits that are likely to activate that natal context so that you can make accurate archetypal assessments of what exactly is going to happen or what types of themes and events around what times. Finally, we have something like horary. Now, in horary, what we're doing is asking a very particular question and trying to get really refine the predictive element. So we're asking if they will pass and when. You'll see it says, when will they pass in the top left? But the assumption was, will they pass like imminently? And if so, when? So here's how we do this one. She's asking about her husband's grandmother, which is her father's mother. Which is his father's mother. So we use derived houses to do this in a horary chart. We cast it for the moment the question is asked. This was with my client yesterday. So the question was asked around 12:33 p.m. where I live in Minnesota. And this is the chart that came up. So in the question, we go to the seventh house. This is the partner's house. From a derived house standpoint, which is common in horary, we start counting off around the wheel. We get to the fourth house from the seventh, which is the 10th. That would be the husband's father's house. We are looking to the father's mother, which would be the 10th house from the father's house, which takes us back to the seventh. So those are called, that's called derived houses, which is a technique that we teach in my horary class. That means that the planet that's going to rule or represent the grandmother in this question is going to be Mercury. Now, Mercury is retrograde and under the beams of the sun, which is a picture of the life force diminishing, and she's very, very old. We also see that the moon is approaching a conjunction with Mercury, and the moon is the radix ruler of the eighth house of death. We see that closing in within less than 3 degrees. So we do see the ruler of the house of death approaching grandma imminently. And that would be within about 3 degrees, which we use symbolically in horary. You can often do this. We say about 3 degrees can mean about 3 hours, 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years. Well, in roughly 3 months from now, you see Neptune coming over that around that 21st degree, opposing her moon, sitting on his descendant just after that eclipse in his fourth house. So what do I say in a case like that? Oh, you know, grandma's going to die in 3 months. No, I say, well, I show her, she was a student, so she could follow along with this. It depends on who I'm speaking with, but I showed her the reasoning of the horary while we were sitting together. And I said, look, I would say that if everyone's sort of anticipating that she could pass, and if you're trying to prepare yourself psychically for the load of, you know, supporting your husband that you're probably going to have to do, because this is someone that's very beloved in the family, it's going to be a hard loss, then I don't think you're out of line to believe that it could happen very soon. I would say within 2 to 3 months coming up here, so 2 to 3 degree range, when Neptune does oppose your moon again. However, don't stay attached to that outcome. I'm not always right. It's sometimes, you know, predictive astrology is it hits and sometimes it doesn't. But I do believe we have some radical showings here. Radical showings meaning that there's correspondence between multiple charts, timelines, and using a specific predictive tool like horary in the midst of the natal work to kind of confirm and collaborate or corroborate. So you have some good reason to believe that maybe somewhere between December and January, she could indeed pass. It's not a huge surprise. It's not a shock to anyone. I wouldn't do this kind of work necessarily, let's say, with someone who's asking a question about someone that's healthy and young and probably has lots of years left to live. They just probably wouldn't even go there with a person, but this is a special case, right? But it's so important if you're going to study astrology from a traditional perspective and you want to have the ability to do predictive work, to be able to analyze natal context and karma. And that's a whole year worth of focusing just on that. And I'm just showing you a little small snippet of how I looked at her moon and noticed something going on there that could be challenging based on its placement in the chart. Year two is all about knowing when different kinds of karma in the chart is going to be activated and therefore what types of events are likely to happen around what time. And then horary, my third year program, many people take some of these at the same time. Horary is about fine tuning and being able to answer very specific predictive questions or help fine tune timing in some cases. So that's all three levels of my curriculum. There's also a readings and passages course that I teach, which is coming up. I'll be demoing more about what that class is about. Essentially, that class follows in the footsteps of year one. The end of my year one program, I invite tons of live clients in, like this one that I just showed you, but you actually get to see me go through this live with the person. So you can see how I'm using all the theory that we study. Then, you get into readings and passages course, what we're doing is we're having a whole year worth of live craft client workshops. So you're going to see me work with people and demonstrate all sorts of specific advanced theory. So I'll talk more about readings and passages coming up. I wanted to take some time to demo a chart reading today. Even if you're not going to take my classes, I hope this kind of stuff is interesting for you. It teaches you more about astrology if you're just at home learning by yourself. I try to throw out chart demos from time to time because I know sometimes people don't have the time or the money or the energy in their schedule to like take a full class. But if you are interested in studying, remember that time is running out. We are closing in on the registration deadline for the early bird payment. You have to take advantage of that before the class starts next month. We have a 12 monthly payment plan you can use, 12 month payment plan. We also have need-based tuition. If you're someone who's on a tight budget or you're struggling financially for one reason or another, check that out. Make sure you take advantage of it. Over 50% of my students use the need-based tuition. I really take a lot of pride in making sure that all of that astrological education is accessible. So I set my prices and trust that people who can pay the price, the asking price for the course will, and that people who are really struggling and need some help can still take the program. So it really works out. It's the same reason I create free content all year round. And then at the end of the year, ask people to just donate and support my channel if they want to. I really feel like trust and making a variety of different budget options available for people in different socioeconomic situations is the best way to do at least my version of a spiritual business. So at any rate, it's been a pleasure talking to you for a longer video today. I hope you guys enjoyed learning about the nodes of the moon, Venus in the South Node, a chart demo, lots of good stuff. Thank you to my client who, by the way, the second part of that reading is was really all about, you know, diving into how do you work with Neptune and the moon? Because, you know, from a predictive level, we prepared her for the weather that might be coming. But then there's a whole beautiful conversation that can unfold around working with those archetypes in our lives. And so there's a counseling and psychology component to every reading as well. But it's nice to have both tools in your kit. Anyway, okay, I'm done rambling. I hope you guys have a great day and we'll see you again tomorrow. Take it easy, everyone.